Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Over the course of the past couple of days, in the run-up and on the occasion of the 15th anniversary of 9/11, there's been an awful lot of discussion, understandably, about the nature of the conflict we find ourselves in, notably really starting for many of us, at least on that day, 15 years ago, and why it is we haven't done better in fighting this war, and whether, in fact, we are safer as a result of our efforts to this point. I'm very pleased to welcome for the first time Elon Giorno. He is a fellow and a director of policy research at the Ayn Rand Institute and the co-author of a new book, Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism, From George W. Bush to Barack Obama and Beyond. He is a man who's published widely in a number of other outlets, Foreign Policy, Middle East Quarterly, the Claremont Review of Books being a few of my favorites. And it's a delight to have him here. Welcome and congratulations on the publication of your book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So what I'm struck by, Elon, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it as it's, I think, central to your thesis, is when we hear people talking, as they seem to do increasingly now, about some ideology that animates the threat we're facing, yet they fail, it seems, basically pretty much without exception, to name it. What's up with that? And can you help us identify what the ideology is that we're confronting?
Definitely. I think the place to start is the natural starting point for most people is ignorance, but we're 15 years past that point for anybody to take seriously that excuse. And I think it's never been a secret what this ideology is. I think the failure comes from our refusal to think seriously about it and honestly about it. I would say we call it Islamic totalitarianism. It has a lot in common with previous incarnations of a totalitarianism. This one is rooted not in the works of Karl Marx. This one is rooted in the works of the religion of Islam. But it really is an ideology. It's a movement that seeks to impose Islamic rule as far and wide as they can by force. And we've seen examples of it, the Taliban regime pre-2001 in Afghanistan, Iran still to this day, Islamic State. There are variations on the same theme and severity, and I would include Saudi Arabia too. So one of the reasons people refuse to understand what this is it makes people very uncomfortable to imagine or even to believe that a religious doctrine could lead to a totalitarian political system. And I think the other factor here is that if we look ourselves in the mirror, how many people really take any ideology seriously in our society, any belief system? It's hard to imagine that anybody else does, meaning the enemy does, and that the enemy is actuated by a belief system, an integrated view of the world. So it is a failure of imagination, as people used to say after 9/11, but it's deeper than operational, it's deeper than intelligence. It has to do with the role of ideas and philosophic ideas. And I consider Islamic totalitarianism to have a philosophic orientation, and that's a big problem. We need to really think seriously about that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We're talking with Elon Giorno, the co-author of Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism, From George W. Bush to Barack Obama and Beyond. And there is, in your title, of course, the key point, which is that this is not a partisan critique, Elon. This is something that we've seen afflicting American policy going back to, well, literally the day of 9/11, I think, and certainly throughout both Republican and Democratic administrations. I kind of describe this the way I think its adherents do, as Sharia, to make a distinction between, you know, the practice of just the faith and this political totalitarian program. But there's no getting around it that those who follow Sharia, you know, in the authoritative fashion, are obliged to try to impose it, as you say, in a manner that is very reminiscent of Nazism and communism and fascism before it on the entire world, Muslim, by the way, and non-Muslim alike.
Yes, I think it follows from having a doctrine rooted in faith, essentially, which is, and I believe communism was a faith doctrine too. And it follows because how do you persuade people to follow your faith? There's no evidence or logic that, by definition, that you could point to, no facts in the world. And the way people accept this doctrine is that they've been told to accept it by an authority, and they themselves see themselves as authoritative and seeking to impose it on other people. I think there's really no way around it. And you see this in different examples through history. It's a serious problem that we're reluctant to believe that there really are people who are actuated by these ideas. On the how to characterize it, I definitely make a distinction between people who espouse the religion of Islam and people who act in the name of a totalitarian goal. I think there's a different and distinct and should be separated. And it's important to see that there's a different. But my view is that every jihadist or everyone who's seeking to impose Islamic totalitarianism is a Muslim. But it's not the case, far from it, that every Muslim is seeking to do that. That's not true at all.
This is obviously made more difficult, this grasping reality, as you've indicated, by the fact that some of our putative friends, like the Saudis and the Pakistanis, are deeply engaged in this kind of totalitarianism and spreading it worldwide. Another factor is that the Muslim Brotherhood, a group that many have embraced as the alternatives to the violent extremists that we're endlessly warned are the real enemy here, not Sharia-adherent Muslims, not jihadists, even violent extremists. What would you say about the role of these entities, the state sponsors on the one hand and the Muslim Brotherhood on the other, and how they fit into why we are so willfully blind about this problem and therefore less able to deal with it?
I think it's crucial to recognize that state sponsorship is a necessary condition for the existence of Islamic totalitarianism, the fact that it's grown over the last 40, 50 years to become this powerful force in the world and a dangerous, destructive one. And I think it's integral to seeing what needs to happen to stop it, too. Now, I think the Muslim Brotherhood is important in many ways to understanding the problem, because, as I'm sure you know, it is one of the origins for so many of the splinter groups that ended up in Al-Qaeda, and not just Al-Qaeda, of course, Hamas being another example. I think what's significant here is, as you put it, there's this view that we can divide along a continuum called radicals versus and extremists versus moderates. I don't think you can be a moderate. I don't think there's any meaning to that if what you stand for is Islamic totalitarianism. There's no moderation in that, and moderation is not something you can apply to ideas. That either you believe in it and you act on it, or you don't, or you're compromising on it. But that you still have to recognize the full implications of the ideas you hold. So from that perspective, I don't think we should be espousing this kind of distinction between radicals and moderates. We need to see what people believe in and what they're acting for and how seriously they take it. And for that reason, it's tragic that for at least during the Obama administration, at certain moments when the Muslim Brotherhood rose to power in Egypt through elections, they were suddenly christened moderates and people we can deal with. That is completely ahistorical, delusional. And I grant the fact that people, certain groups can pretend or act as if they're trying to soften their message. And some groups do soften their message, and you have to be conscious of that. But that's not the thing to assume from the get-go. And I think we've allowed ourselves to be deluded this way, both on the Muslim Brotherhood and other groups as well that are suddenly decided, oh, well, these people are people we can deal with, like Pakistan suddenly, or Saudi Arabia. To me, that's one of the biggest tragedies of American foreign policy, is that we regard them as an ally.
Well, and just to stay with the Brotherhood for one last second, and we'll have to let you go with this, Ilan Jorno, but you have this continuum being bifurcated in the Obama administration, at least between so-called violent extremists and those who are nonviolent, and therefore we can take counsel. It's not just that we, you know, wound up getting sucked into their meme in Egypt, but they are now largely, I think, driving American policy towards the Islamic world in this country to our great detriment. Ilan Durno, thanks so much for your time today. Next up, Richard Pollack joins us. We'll talk about the Clinton Foundation, Clinton emails, Clinton health, and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by Richard Pollack. He is the senior investigative reporter at the Daily Caller News Foundation, one of the country's preeminent investigative journalists, in fact, with considerable experience in a number of publications and media outlets, including the Washington Examiner, PJ Media, ABC News, Good Morning America, where he was a producer, as well as for Fox News Sunday with the late and much lamented Tony Snow. These days, he is making pretty much a full-time job of monitoring what's going on with the scandals, the various scandals involving Hillary Clinton, her emails, foundation, what's going on with her health and so on. And we're delighted to have a chance to catch up with him a little bit about all of that. Welcome back, Richard.
Thank you for having me.
Richard, let's start with the latest on this email scandal. I gather that you were rather dismayed, as were I think most of us, by how the FBI handled the release of its long-awaited report on its investigation thereof.
Yes. The first thing that's very troubling is that Director Comey and the FBI decided to release their long-awaited report on the eve of Labor Day, on a Friday afternoon, late in the afternoon, in advance of a three-day weekend. Now, that is what you do if you try to bury news. And I think that people who thought highly of Director Comey would not have believed that he would have really stooped to such a stunt, but he did. And that was the first thing that really, I think, bothered an awful lot of reporters who've been following this. Why release it on the eve of a holiday? Now, the second thing is, and most people don't know this, nearly half of the 58 pages are blank. They are completely redacted. There is no sense of who these documents were about, who generated them. It is completely blank. And so that is a very disquieting discovery as well. Now, we did find some revelations in it, however. We discovered, for example, that Platte River Networks, which was the company that was handling the backup servers, sent the a laptop and a flash drive to the Hillary campaign staff, or her staff at the time. And apparently, and this is remarkable, they're not sure whether they sent it by USPS or by UPS, United Parcel Service, but they lost it. They lost both the laptop and the thumb drive that had all of the archived materials on it. That's extraordinary. And the other thing that's quite extraordinary is we always heard about Hillary using the BlackBerry phone in the State Department against all rules and regulations imposed by the intelligence community and the National Security Agency. What we didn't know, and we did learn from this investigative report, is that she had not one but 13 different cell phones, and all of them have been lost or damaged and are irretrievable. And so that is a very troubling discovery as well. So this was really a disquieting report as opposed to one that actually sort of cleared the air.
Richard, what you've just said just smacks of a cover-up. And whether it's by the Clinton team, whether it's by the FBI, whether it's by, you know, the press failing to bird dog this as tirelessly as you have, it's really a scandal. And the fact that someone who's engaged in this kind of behavior is, you know, a serious contender for the presidency is quite remarkable, I have to say. I understand there are hearings scheduled in the Congress over the next 24 hours or so about this scandal. Tell us what you know about them and what you expect to come of it.
Well, Congressman Jason Chaffetz, who's the chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, this evening, or starting at 5 o'clock today, is going to be holding a very important hearing in which he has subpoenaed members of the intelligence community, the Justice Department, the State Department, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, and the Director of National Intelligence to talk about the email problems. We do not know what information they possess, but it is going to be, I think, a very meaty hearing. And then tomorrow, Chaffetz is going to have a second hearing in which he's actually going to be inviting Platte River, that is the Platte River Network Company in Denver, Colorado, which handled the email server, and also the famous or infamous Brian Pagliano. Mr. Pagliano was the IT worker who worked for Hillary in her presidential campaign, was a political appointee at state, handled and managed the home server in upstate New York, the private server that we all know about. And he received immunity from prosecution for his testimony before the FBI and the Justice Department. We believe he is showing up tomorrow. We do not know whether he'll invoke the Fifth Amendment or whether or not he may actually decide to share with us what he knows.
Richard, the hearings, of course, going to be taking place as we are recording this in the future, but as we are broadcasting this in the past. When you look at the kind of inquiries that we've seen out of the Congress to date, is there reason to believe that something more will come of this than has in the past? There seems to have been sort of a tutting and a lot of thrashing around, but not much in the way of real accountability that should be demanded in light of what's taken place here.
The lack of accountability is an understatement, Frank. There are no individuals who have stepped up to the plate and received any kind of whether it's an indictment or censorship or any other kind of action. You may know that a number of people in the national security community, including General Michael Flynn, have called for the State Department to pull Hillary Clinton's current security clearance, which she currently has. There has been absolutely no actions against any of the named parties that have been involved in this email scandal. And it's, you know, quite troubling for sure.
It is indeed. But I did want to ask you about one other matter that has gotten a lot of attention for obvious reasons in the past day, and that is Hillary Clinton's health. There is a report now that she has pneumonia. She has been fainting. She has been coughing. She has been seen to be maneuvering with great difficulty upstairs and the like. What's your reading on what's going on with regard to that?
We just learned that only on Friday, the campaign learned that Hillary Clinton had pneumonia. But the campaign did not release this information at all. In fact, they claimed that she was perfectly fine. Then on Sunday morning in New York at a 9/11 event, they decide to rush her back to the waiting motorcade because she apparently fell ill. They said that it was heat stroke, so to speak, and dehydration. They did not mention at that point that she had been formally diagnosed with pneumonia. Then she goes to her daughter's $10 million apartment in New York. That's Chelsea Clinton's apartment, and stays there for a while, emerges from the apartment, turns to the reporters that are assembled across the street, and she says, "I am perfectly fine," and she smiles, and she gets into the motorcade and leaves, and only later do we learn that she didn't have heat stroke. She is not perfectly fine, but in fact, she has pneumonia, and that she's had pneumonia apparently for quite some time, because according to the doctor, Dr. Barback, she has been coughing for quite some time, and it's been prolonged and serious and has not gotten better. And I think that this series of events, this timeline, shows just how lacking in openness and transparency the campaign is, how they will completely continue to put out lie after lie, despite the fact that they know that at some point the truth's going to come out.
Richard, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but we do look forward to your further reporting on all of these issues, and notably on the Clinton Foundation scandals. We'll look forward to having you back to discuss those in short order. Next up, Steve Groves joins us from the Heritage Foundation on Obama's legacy of fundamentally transforming the U.S. Constitution. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260.
the answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Over the 9/11 anniversary weekend, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and others spoke a lot about the ideology that brought us that act of jihad. Curiously, it was not generally named. The more precise one gets about the ideological impetus behind Islamic terrorism, the more difficult it becomes to draw a distinction between the violent jihadists who seek to impose worldwide what they call Sharia and those who are pursuing the same goal through other means. And the more evident is that reality, the more exposed are those, like many of the weekend's talking heads, who have ignored or empowered the stealthy jihadists of the Muslim Brotherhood. This anniversary and this election are times for holding accountable those whose willful blindness regarding Sharia and the Brotherhood has done much to deny us victory over the global jihad movement 15 years on. This is Frank Affney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by a friend and colleague, Stephen Groves. He is the Bernard and Barbara Lomas Senior Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and really one of the country's preeminent authorities on the machinations that the Obama administration is going through at the moment to circumvent, undermine, well, I would say fundamentally transform the Constitution of the United States, specifically with respect to the treaty-making powers of the Senate and how they're supposed to work in a checks and balances arrangement. Steve Groves, among other things, has spent a considerable amount of time behind enemy lines over in garden spots of the universe where treaties like the Climate Change Accord have been hammered out, keeping an eye on them, dogging the malfactions that are going on, and also reporting back, needless to say, on what the upshot of it all has been. Steve Groves, welcome back. It's good to have you with us. It's been too long.
It's been too long, Frank. I hope you're doing well.
I am indeed. Thank you very much for joining me. Let's talk a little bit about this climate change, well, treaty by any reasonable definition of the word, and yet the president is treating it as something else and thereby simply blowing it past the United States Senate. What is up with that?
Well, you nailed it in the introduction, Frank. The president looks at Article 2 of the Constitution, where the treaty-making power is, and just like many other parts of the Constitution that have been bent or ignored over the past 8 years, he blows right by it. And so this major, apparently globe-saving accord on climate change, he negotiated in Paris in December, and it's so massive and so world-saving and ocean-level dropping that he's not going to bother to send it to the Senate for Senate review, advice, and consent. He's going to pretend that it's not a treaty, even though it so clearly is by any objective measure, and he's going to pretend that it is an executive agreement.
And the United States Senate, having basically taken a dive on the Iran deal, which allowed him also to describe as something other than a treaty, seems to be good with this? I mean, do they have no voice or ability to exercise some sort of, cost to the president for this kind of anti-constitutional behavior?
Well, the Senate and the House could, if they really cared about it, do something about this. I mean, there have been some members that have been very good on it, some that have made a lot of noise about it, some that have denounced treating this as an executive agreement. But when the rubber met the road during the last appropriations bills or the last authorizations, that the money that the president demanded to go to a green climate fund, $3 billion worth as just kind of a down payment, was allowed to make its way through the system. And both the House and the Senate, for various reasons, deal-making, log rolling, whatever you want to call it, allowed that money to get through. So it was very disappointing, and hopefully it's something that we can turn the tide on in future Congresses.
Well, there is, as I understand it, going to be some further bill, omnibus bill, to provide some additional funding, at least for the next few months. Presumably, this could be revisited there, could it not, Steve?
Well, presumably, if we could put in language, although the money on the $3 billion seems to have sailed, I think it's gone. I think it's reprogrammed from other existing accounts. You see, the thing is that the administration already has the money sitting in accounts somewhere, and instead of going to the accounts they were originally authorized for, they're going to pool a bunch of money from here, there, and there until they can cobble together the $3 billion that was promised. The only thing that I think the Congress could do is put down what we tried last time, which is an explicit provision saying that no funds shall go to the Green Climate Fund under any circumstances. But that language got cut out, and both houses went along with it. So I don't know if there's much of an appetite. It's scandalous.
Steve, this is going to be coming again at the Congress. You reward bad behavior, you get more of it. And with another Obama initiative at the UN this month called the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, talk a bit about what's going on with that. And again, what's the context for this? And how could the Senate possibly allow this to go forward?
Correct. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, or CTBT, which prohibits any countries from testing any type of nuclear device to make sure that they're safe or that they work or that they're still operable. The United States has very intelligently not ratified this agreement, though it was signed. This was a rare instance of a treaty that actually went to the floor of the Senate. And under the leadership of, I believe, Senator Kyle, I think with great support from Frank Gaffney and the Center for Security Policy and others, defeated CTBT.
By an actual majority vote, you're right.
Correct. It went down on the floor, which is just it's rare to happen, but it does happen. And so, again, like the Paris Climate Change Agreement, the president knows he can't go to the Senate and ask for this agreement to be approved. He knows he doesn't have the votes. So yet again, there's been this rumbling of doing an end run and achieving the treaty's goals of CTBT without going through the constitutional process. And from what I'm hearing, that is to go to the UN Security Council.
And the thought being that they'll get the UN Security Council to say what and with what kind of binding effect, Steve?
The scuttlebutt is that the administration will pursue some type of binding Security Council resolution prohibiting nuclear testing. So you take some of the provisions out of CTBT, you rewrite them as a Security Council resolution, And if you can somehow get Russia and China to go along with it, because they also haven't ratified CTPT, all of a sudden you've got this international prohibition, you know, kind of like what they did with Iran, and saying, oh, well, you know, we can't violate international law and our agreement on the Security Council resolution by engaging in nuclear testing. So CTBT or no, Constitution or no, the president is attempting to achieve that end.
This, too, is a travesty, and I believe will come back to bite us as our nuclear deterrent continues to atrophy without the kind of testing that is needed to make sure, as you say, Steve, that our systems are reliable and safe and effective. And before we let you go, Steve, let me ask you about one other issue. You have been one of the country's real duty experts on something called the Law of the Sea Treaty. It actually did something useful. I'm not much of a fan of it, nor are you, of course, but it did something useful with respect to the Chinese claims to parts of the, or much of, really, the South China Sea. Where are we on that treaty, and specifically the Chinese flouting of it as it relates to, you know, the status of the islands that they're now fortifying and making claims about?
Well, the status in the Senate is unknown. I think the president has other interesting things on his plate. As you remember, they tried, like the devil, to get it ratified back in 2012, where you and I once again, you know, fought shoulder to shoulder with many of our friends and allies and resoundingly defeated the Law of the Sea Treaty, despite Senator Kerry's efforts in the Senate and Secretary Clinton's efforts at state and President Obama's efforts. So that went down flaming in defeat to the greater good of the country. Now, that doesn't mean that that China, who is a party to the treaty, actually follows what they're required to do in the South China Sea by bullying its neighbors, by not following the ruling of a tribunal that it signed up to follow, and it lost a big case to the Philippines. Of course, what we must do moving forward and is make sure our Navy is strong, well-equipped, and prepared to perform its missions in the South China Sea, keep those shipping lanes open, work with allies in the region to ensure that China does not become a hegemon power in the South China Sea. Of course, as you and I know, all of these goals can be achieved without the U.S. actually ratifying the Law of the Sea Treaty.
Steve Groves, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today and terrific work you do at the Heritage Foundation. And I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Thank you, Frank.
Godspeed. Next up, we'll talk the South China Sea business, among other things, with Gordon Chang right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. in an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about civilization jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization. The Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hello, I'm Ace Lyons. As a retired 4-star admiral who served as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, is a special privilege for me to talk to you about an important new book just released by the Center for Security Policy, China Prepares for Conflict, and Why We Must Do the Same. The book explains that while the Obama administration has dithered over the deterioration of the Middle East and ignored Asia, China has been moving to challenge and displace the dominant role the United States has played in this region and the world since the end of World War II. I am one of 9 co-authors of this important book. The others are former Senator Jim Talent, Gordon Chang, Peter Navarro, Kevin Freeman, Bill Gertz, Frank Gaffney, Fred Flights, and Dean Chang. I explained in my chapter how China's efforts over the last 20 years to seize control of almost the entire South China Sea is an indication of new assertiveness to advance its regional dominance at the expense of the United States. I take issue with President Obama's benign neglect of the threat from China and how Beijing is building islands in the South China Sea that it plans to turn into stationary aircraft carriers to threaten freedom of navigation in this region. Like the other authors of this book, I believe the next president must act immediately to restore American leadership and its military power, both of which have been seriously undermined by the disastrous policies of President Obama. We urgently need to modernize and increase the size of our land, naval, and air forces to stand up to China and other adversaries worldwide. We also need to recognize and counter the growing cyber and intelligence threats from China. The bottom line is that our nation needs to act now. I strongly commend this important book, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. You can read it for free as an ebook on the Center's website, securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we have with us Gordon Chang, our duty expert on the Far East and what's going on in it and how it relates to all of us. He is, of course, the duty expert for a lot of people, including The Daily Beast, Forbes.com, World Affairs Journal. He's also featured frequently at Fox News, among other places. The author of 2 terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, welcome back. It is always good to have you with us.
It is always great to be on with you, Frank.
Well, we've got a lot going on at the moment, don't we? Nuclear showdown seems to be the leitmotif. North Korea has conducted 1 nuclear test, its 5th. There's reports that it may be spinning up to do another one. Tell us what you make of that, Gordon, and particularly the timing at the moment.
North Korea's fifth test on Friday will soon be followed up by a sixth one, according to Yonhap News Agency, which is the semi-official South Korean outlet. I think that the reason is that the North Koreans are selling this stuff or want to, and they need to improve it. And at this particular time, they don't see any pushback in the international community. They don't see pushback from Washington, but they also don't see pushback from China. We got to remember that a senior North Korean nuclear envoy arrived in Beijing on Tuesday before the test. We don't know what was said in those conversations, but clearly the North Koreans would not have gone forward with Friday's test if they thought that China was going to impose real costs on Pyongyang. So therefore, I think they saw essentially a green light from Beijing and didn't see pushback from Washington. So why not test?
Gordon, explore this a little bit further with us, would you? What's in it for China to have North Korea acting up in this fashion? Why would they not be interested in imposing costs? We're endlessly told China is our partner in trying to restrain the North Koreans, and yet from what you've just said and so much other evidence, that certainly doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, sees the United States as his primary strategic adversary across the board. He's not going to do anything that we want. And, of course, we want to put the North Korean nuke program back in the box. Also because in the short term, China gets a lot of benefit from North Korean provocations. Every time they do act up, you know, we send an envoy to Beijing. The Chinese, who are ruthlessly pragmatic, obtain concessions from us. You know, it's another reason for South Korea and the United States to be good to China. It distracts us from things which we think are important in the region, like the South China and the East China Seas. So, you know, in the short term, if North Korea didn't exist, China would invent it. Now, long term, this is really bad for China. Most Chinese analysts and policymakers, I think, understand that. But short term, China is not going to change its policy. As a matter of fact, it's doubling down on North Korea. Trade with North Korea is now back up to pre-sanction levels, indicating Beijing is now busting sanctions left, right, and center.
And Gordon, you've indicated in your piece at Forbes, I believe, that this may have deleterious effects on the Chinese economy if, in fact, there is movement towards more rigorous sanctions, which a lot of people are talking about at the moment.
Yes. You know, I think that this fifth test, although, you know, in some sense it's no different than the fourth test and won't be any different from the sixth in material respects, this has sort of changed people's views about a number of things, including China. So, for instance, Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter said a couple days ago that this test was China's fault, which is a striking thing for an American official to say, especially in public. You have both candidates, Trump and Clinton, promising tougher sanctions and also to impose costs on China. Trump talked about this in February after the fourth test, which was in January, and Secretary Clinton just mentioned American leverage over Chinese entities. So she's talking about secondary sanctions, and she did that just a few days ago. So clearly right now there is a growing consensus to do something, but that consensus has yet to translate into hard policy. And until we do that, China is going to continue to aid North Korea. And we know that some of this aid is extremely illicit. For instance, Chinese companies have been selling uranium hexafluoride to the North Koreans. That, of course, is going to be refined into the core for a bomb. And they've been selling other components for a uranium and plutonium devices. The United States has not imposed secondary sanctions on China. This is the fault of the Obama administration. Clearly, we need to do something because until we impose those costs on Beijing, nothing's going to change. The North Koreans will make rapid progress on both nukes and missiles.
And these are, just to be clear, Gordon Chang, nuclear warheads that will be mated on missiles that in due course, if not fairly short order, will be capable of reaching the United States, not just our allies. This is a serious national security problem. Hey, Gordon, you mentioned that Xi Jinping doesn't want to do anything to help the Americans, yet he did sign on to this climate change treaty, had joined President Obama, let me say, to advance it. We talked earlier in the program with Steve Groves about the implications of that for the U.S. Constitution, the way this was done. But Talk about Xi's interest in getting that that bit done, locking in the United States.
Well, this climate change ratification, which, by the way, is just merely sending confirmation to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. So that's what is the extent of ratification. But it is an end run around the Senate. I think China has two interests here. One of them is that this is something that President Obama is very proud about. And so the Chinese extract concessions because they say, look, we're helping you on climate. But also we got to remember that the Chinese economy, especially the industrial sector, is in trouble. CO2 emissions in 2005 fell by something like 3.4%. So China's going to meet its commitments even if it doesn't have any sort of green initiatives, largely because they're going to be putting less carbon in the air regardless. So we're giving concessions to China for something that would happen anyway. You know, of course, it would be nice that the air be cleaner, but the Chinese are going to clean their air largely because their economy is not strong enough to continue the emissions at the pace that we have seen in the last several years.
Well, it'll be fascinating to watch how this plays out. I have the feeling it will screw us and not do a great deal to improve their performance. Gordon, lastly, let me turn to the fact that, as you mentioned, the South China Sea is an area where we're seeing increasing challenges from the Chinese. The Russians are joining them in some exercises in that region. What's going on with that? And I gather there's some interesting exercises the United States is engaged in with India. Tell us about both, if you would, quickly.
Monday, China and Russia started 8 days of naval drills off of Guangdong Province. One of the things that they're exercising are quote-unquote island-seizing missions. So this is interesting. They say that China says that this is not directed against any third country. That's true. It's directed against all third countries. You know, at the same time, though, the United States and India have army exercises that start on the 14th of this month in a state which is very close to China, Uttarakhand. And essentially, you remember, you train where you think you're going to fight. And in this particular state, which is actually quite close to New Delhi, there have been Chinese incursions in the last month or so. So India is obviously worried. We're there helping them. This is a very positive development. Kudos to the Defense Department and the Obama administration for doing this.
Well, we will be watching that closely, but also what's going on with the Scarborough Shoal. Anything in the way of an update on that, Gordon Chang?
Very little. The Chinese ships are still around Scarborough, but they haven't started reclamation. The president talked to Xi Jinping in March, according to the Financial Times, warned him of serious consequences. I think President Obama said pretty much the same thing on the Saturday of the G20. We'll have to see how this plays out. If China starts reclaiming, it means that deterrence has failed, and that will have consequences across the board.
You'll be following it, as will we. Gordon Chang, with your help, thank you very much. Look forward to talking with you in a week's time, and we'll look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.